Hello, this is your host, Mike Petrilli of the Thomas B. Fordham Institute here at the Education Gadfly Show online at edexcellence.net. Now, please join me in welcoming my special guest co-host, our very own American Idol, Stafford Palmieri.
Hello, Mike.
How are you, Stafford?
I am doing well. How are you?
I'm fine. I'm fine. This is an all Fordham version of the Education Gadfly Show. Rick is, I don't know where Rick is, gallivanting about somewhere.
He's in a bar somewhere. It's 5 o'clock somewhere, right?
We always give Rick the hard time about that. That's right. All right, Stafford. Well, I'm very excited to be co-hosting the show with you today.
Oh, great. I'm excited also.
You know, I understand that there was, I don't know, maybe a month or so ago when you and Rick co-hosted
together. We did, except I was sitting in that chair and Rick was sitting where I'm sitting.
Because you are now in the Rick chair.
I am in the Rick chair.
Very good. Well, let us get started. Lots to cover. We are going to play Pardon the Gadfly. We're going to have the research minute, and Mickey will rate that reform in your place.
Yes, he will.
Okay, Christina, let's get going.
Topic one. Secretary of Education Arne Duncan is paying special attention to Detroit these days and offering his particular help to turn it around. This seems strange for a federal official to concern himself so closely with dysfunction of an urban district. What do we make of this?
I think it's a good idea. For a few reasons. One, because most reform has happened on the city level, and two, because the federal government has really no tools in order with which to enact reform from the federal level besides money, which is a weak incentive. And so if he can draw attention to what's going on in Detroit and encourage the local system there to turn itself around, I think that's a good thing.
See, now this is interesting, Stafford, because I think it's a bad idea that he did this for exactly the same reasons that you think it's a good idea, which is that all this change can happen at the local level, and that he has no tools in his toolbox. Look, I mean, on the one hand, you got to give him some credit. There's Arne Duncan, the perennial do-gooder, trying to do good in this terrible education system. They're in the middle of a huge crisis, fiscally and otherwise. And so, you know, his instincts are that he wants to go out there and try to save the Detroit schools. But I don't think he has much of a chance of succeeding. I mean, maybe if his goal is to try to get legislators there to agree to mayoral control, maybe he'll succeed on that front. That can happen. If that's his goal, fine. But in terms of fixing Detroit public schools, I don't think there's a whole lot the Secretary of Education can do about that. And now he's, you know, raising a lot of hopes on the ground that something might be done, and I think that he's going to find this is a really hard one to do from Washington.
See, I agree with you that I don't think he can fix Detroit personally, or that Washington can fix Detroit, but I think that what he's actually doing is just trying to encourage the local and state infrastructure to fix itself.
Yeah.
And he's using his bully pulpit.
Yeah. Because it's a lack of encouragement that is the reason that these people aren't fixing their schools. I don't know. I just don't buy that. And I just think that right now, there's plenty of attention on Detroit public schools. But like most big cities, the challenges here are political. They're structural. I'm not sure what you can do to Detroit right now. But hey, go get him, Arne.
All right.
Topic two.
All right. With one of the strongest teachers unions in the nation, Massachusetts might make a strong case for the argument that unions are not an impediment to school effectiveness and might even be a promoter of it. Is there any merit to this line of reasoning?
So, Stafford, we've got a big debate going on our blog this week, Flypaper. This started when I posted something about this argument that I heard Diane Ravitch make. She said, look, if unions are such a problem, how do you explain Massachusetts? She also said, how do you explain Finland? But let's focus on Massachusetts, right? Best NAEP scores in the country, big progress in the last decade in improving those scores, including for poor minority kids. And yet Massachusetts, everybody knows, is a strong union state. Well, here's my response, is as I thought about it, reached out to some friends for some help, got some help, you know, lifelines, said this, look, first of all, actually the unions in Massachusetts haven't been very strong in the last 15 years. They've gotten rolled on accountability, on charter schools, on teacher testing, all kinds of things. And number two, where it does matter in terms of being a strong collective bargaining state, it's true that the Massachusetts unions are strong in that respect, but in weak union states or non-union states, the stuff that would have been collectively bargained just gets into state law. We know this from lots of studies. So the reality on the ground is the same. I mean, sure, there's tenure protections in Massachusetts, but there's tenure protections everywhere.
I agree with you on the first point. I don't know enough about the second point to really comment, but I would also say that we just haven't seen the effects of the resurgence of the union in Massachusetts, and that the state legislators really did roll the unions for the last 15 years. And I believe it was in EdNext that Jamie Gass and Charlie Chepo were pointing out that MCAS scores that were released last September actually have dropped. The pass rate has dropped significantly. And that, honestly, you know, give it another 2-3 years and we're going to see Massachusetts not doing as well, especially in light of the different ways that Deval Patrick has backed off with 21st right. century skills, with trying to change the MCAS, et cetera.
Right. So the unions finally got their Democratic governor that they've been trying to get right. for years. And lo and behold, they're pushing, you know, they're no longer pushing the gas on education reform.
There was another point that Diane Ravitch actually made where she said that the point of unions, that unions don't have a direct effect on student performance, and that actually their point is to give rights and dignity to teachers. I would agree with the first point, that they do definitely get rights from being in a union, but I would absolutely disagree that they get dignity. And I would say that in fact that unions have turned the teaching profession into a blue-collar job, that by providing teacher protectionism, you take out the meritorious aspect of being a teacher when you can't get fired for a bad job. And that influences the entire profession. And I think that actually does maybe indirectly affect student performance.
Okay, well said, Stafford. Topic number 3.
Libby Quaid from the Associated Press seems to believe that U.S. performance internationally is really not as bad as it appears. Is she right?
Libby. Ah, our good friend Libby. I don't know. What do you think, Stafford? Is Libby going soft? She's now an apologist for the public education system?
I'm going to have to say yes, but I did agree with some of the points she made. She pointed out, as Tom Lovelace did, that PISA is not, comparing PISA and TIMSS is not an appropriate comparison, because PISA measures self-efficacy, whereas TIMSS actually measures performance.
Okay, no, hold on. Let's back up, because okay. the point here is that while we don't look very good on PISA, she argues, right. we actually look pretty good on TIMSS.
On TIMSS, yes. Sorry, yes, that was the point. And so while she's right in that regard, at the same time, this kind of smacked of broader boulder to me, that we can make excuses for socioeconomic status and, you know, the incidence of single mothers and whatever else we want to make excuses for in affecting student performance. But in the end of the day, that doesn't solve any problems.
Right, because that's another point she makes. Well, these other countries aren't as diverse. They don't have, you know, they have social safety nets. We don't have the typical arguments. Even on this TIMSS PISA thing, I mean, it is true that if you just look at TIMSS quickly, as you say, oh, wow, the United States looks like we're, you know, above the average compared to these other countries. And in PISA, we're more in the middle of the pack or the bottom of the pack. But, you know, lo and behold, if you dig into TIMSS, that's because there's a lot of developing countries that participate in TIMSS. They don't participate in PISA. So it's a totally different mix of countries. So, yes, we better be beating sub-Saharan Africa. I don't even know if they participate. But, okay, well let's see. Good developing countries in Latin America. I mean, places where, yes, we should be having an advantage. The question is, how are we stacking up against other industrialized developed nations? And by any metric, particularly if you look at our older students, once we're heading towards college, the answer is we don't stack up looking very good. Nope. The answer is, Libby, you've gone soft. All right. Well, that's all the time we have for Pardon the Gadfly. It is now time for everybody's favorite part of the show, the Research Minute. Amber, I understand
how
you were
you
up
doing?
Late last night doing some education research.
Up late and wrote the research minute on the metro, so I hope I can read my handwriting.
All right, that's what I like to hear. You always burn the midnight oil just to make sure that next morsel of education research can be born
into
the world.
Hopefully it's a good one this week.
Okay, Amber, what you got for us?
We got a new survey out by William Howe and Marty West in Education Next called Educating the Public. They present findings from a national survey that show that when the public is given accurate information about what is currently being spent in public schools, their support for increased spending and their confidence that more spending will improve student learning both decline. Mm. Also, when the public is given accurate information about how much the average teacher earns, their support for higher teacher salaries also declines. Respondents in the survey actually underestimated average teacher salaries in their state by more than $14,000. A final interesting tidbit, roughly 40% of the general public is undecided about their support for charter schools, and this uncertainty remains even when they're told that charters cannot charge tuition or provide religious instruction. But when the data are sliced by political ideology, liberals were more likely to support them, given this additional information, and conservatives less likely by small margins.
Ooh, well, within the research minute allotment. Thank you, Amber.
See, that when I hand, when I write it, I think it's longer than when I type it. I think there's something to that.
Probably, you know, it hurts your hand to be out there writing it.
There you go. Right,
so let's get, I mean, so the key information here is that, and this came out in a previous survey, is that people vastly they overestimate how much teachers make. Wait, overestimate? Underestimate. They underestimate how much teachers make. They underestimate how much we spend on our schools. I mean, so $14,000. So what, they think that teachers are making on average, what?
50, I can't remember.
Yeah, so they're probably guessing in the 30s, and it's more like in the high 40s and the 50s. And same with the school spending. There's a big difference between how
per
much.
People.
Yeah.
Right.
All right.
I mean, and what was interesting too, which I didn't have time to say. So, you know, they're basically presenting questions two ways, one with information, one with less information. But when you look at what teachers say, even when you give the teachers additional information about, you know, how much they actually make, they still think that they should be making more.
That's not surprising. Of course. Yes. I think the same thing every time I open up my paycheck.
All right. But African-American people, actually were much more inclined to paying them less when they were found out this information. So there's some little nuances in the data that I didn't have time, but it's very interesting.
No, but that one is very interesting. So because you would imagine that, you know, African-American salaries, we know, are of course much lower than for the population as a whole. And when they hear that, wow, the average teacher is making, you know, upwards of $50,000+, they all of a sudden
seems
say,
like a lot, yeah.
Wow, really?
Right, yeah.
And they probably say, wow, that seems awfully generous to me. That's a lot more than I make.
That's right.
One can only hope that once they figure out how much teachers are actually making, the next response is, well, if you're making that much money, you better be doing a better job.
Right.
Yes. Well, and wait till they find out about their retirement benefits. Okay. So the takeaway here is what? That if somebody launched a real information campaign to let parents and taxpayers know this information,
I think so. I mean, I think exactly. I mean, and obviously people, there's an opportunity cost to being informed, and you know, people don't always apprise themselves of that information, but I mean obviously this raises questions about how we word survey questions, and that's a whole, you know, methodological debate. But clearly, when you give a respondent a little more information in the survey, it's going to change how they respond.
All right. So if you're trying to defeat a tax levy for the schools in your information that you pass out and stuff, you should list the actual teacher salaries out there and how much money people are spending on the schools. And
there
you might get some traction.
You go.
Okay.
Yes.
All right. So what's the song?
All right.
For this
the song. We've got lots of confusion around what teachers make and how much money schools actually get. So we've got "Money" by Pink Floyd.
Yes. A very long interview.
It is a long interview.
But I like the cash register part.
I know, the little cha-ching change. Alright, soon we're going to get to money! But we just might not have time to get to it.
Are you a Pink Floyd fan, Emma?
I actually am a Pink Floyd fan.
Oh, that is...
Okay.
All right. I should note that Stafford, being in the Rick chair, did do a little dance in there.
She did.
I did. It wasn't jiggle. Quite as vivacious as Rick's usual
a little
dance
jiggle.
Moves,
all right. Thank you, Amber. Excuse me. And the research minute. Now, stepping into the Rate That Reform chair for the first time. Is that right? First time?
Second time.
For the second time. That's right. I guess when I was gone. See, I'm sometimes not always here. I don't even know what's going on. But hey, for the second time, welcome back to the show, Mickey Muldoon with his Rate That Reform.
Thanks a lot, Mike. It is a pleasure to be making my return.
Don't worry about that rookie mistake, Mickey. I forget every single week that we have a song for Rate That Reform.
So, okay.
And it's so peppy. Okay, so tell us, what are we rating today?
Okay. In preparation for prom, which is coming up, the Women's Health and Issues Club at Arcadia High School in L.A., compiled a list of 300 songs that the club deemed objectionable and degrading to women. The high school then took a look at that list of the 300, and of them, banned 20 songs from the playlist. And that playlist included songs, the banned songs included Flo Rida's Low, which we all know, Lil Wayne's number one Billboard hit Lollipop, and also his cult favorite Amelie, and the perennial club banger Smack That by Akon featuring Eminem.
Wait, by the way, all of these songs are also banned from the Education Gadfly Show. We don't play them. but we can talk about them. That's okay. Yeah.
Okay. So the question is it useful, helpful for Arcadia to prevent students from listening and dancing to the same songs that are at the top of the Billboard charts? Will the high school seniors feel cheated if they don't get to celebrate their farewell fiestas with the same songs that define the American cultural soundtrack circa 2009? Mm. I'm going to say no to the first question and yes to the second. I think that you got to respect the Women's Issues and Health Club for their extensive research, 300 songs.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that it was a fair compromise for the school to agree to only ban 20 of them. but at the end of the day, these are popular radio hits, and allowing them to be played at prom is not the same as endorsing their songs, their language, or their message. So I'm going to say no to censorship. And especially when it's Lil Wayne, because I'm very partial to Lil Wayne. I mentioned this in my previous Rate That Reform, so I'm going to give it a C-.
A C-.
Have you ever listened to the lyrics of Lollipop? They are rather disturbing.
They are, and they're...
I mean, I agree with you. I think this is ridiculous. But at the same time, that particular Lil Wayne song is...
No, and they're actually pretty subpar for Lil Wayne. I mean, I'm being completely honest that I think he is a great... great lyricist, and Lollipop is kind of way below standard for him, and it's a pretty facile kind of metaphor for
what he's trying to get. This is, of course, way over my head, but I'm completely cut off from pop culture, but I can only imagine. So let me get there. So why the 20 songs out of 300, do we know, did they play some of the other 280 songs at prom? Or is that still?
I don't think prom has happened yet, as far as I know.
All right.
But I certainly would like to know whether the school board or principal actually went through and examined the lyrics of all 300 and kind of selected the 20 worst offenders.
Interesting. I know. I mean, this is this could be a lot of work to kind of dig in. And second question, what's the name of the club?
The Women's Health and Issues Club.
Women Health and Issues Clubs. Now, is this club open to boys as well?
I would
think, right? I mean, can you have a club just for women?
I imagine that they are, yeah.
But I would doubt there are any boys in the club.
Right.
In the club.
I don't know. I think there's like a point to this in terms of paying attention to what lyrics say, but at the same time, there's so many better ways that this school's administration could be spending its time that it's absolutely ridiculous. And what about the limo on the way to prom? I am sure they played Lollipop in the limo.
Exactly. Not to mention the after prom party.
Oh, yeah. All right. I remember at my prom, the big issue was our four legs on the floor rule. And that was the kind of the big controversy at prom, you know.
Four legs on the...
Yeah, for couples dancing. You had to keep all four legs on. I mean, that was a big issue.
Have these people not even seen Grease? I mean, when you go back to swing dancing with four legs.
When I was a senior in boarding school, we were allowed to have visitors in our room, and we only had to have three legs on the floor.
Wow.
So
that's interesting. All right. Well, Mickey, well done. May I say, I think you smacked that. And, that is all the time we have for today. Until next week.
I'm Stafford.
And I'm Mike, signing off from the Education Gadfly Show at edexcellence.net.